I suspect it will be. I grinned for the first time. I see you've been getting to know each other. And yes, we've already started looking into it. The doctor smiled too, for about a tenth of a second. Regina was lucky to have someone on hand when she collapsed the other day. You'd be wise to make sure she's just as lucky if, or when, it happens again. It wasn't hard to see why Nana had dubbed this one Dr. Sunshine. But if she was trying to scare me, it was definitely working. Chapter 32. The doctor and I went upstairs to see Nana together. There was safety in numbers, after all. Wasn't that right? Mrs. Cross, Dr. Englefield said, you're doing quite well, all things considered. I'd recommend one more night's stay and then we can send you off.
I like that word, recommend, Nana said. Thank you for your recommendation, doctor. I appreciate it. Now, if you'll excuse us, my grandson is going to take me home. I have things to do today, cakes to bake, thank you notes to write, and so on and so forth.
With a quick shrug from Englefield, I let it go. So did she. 45 minutes later, Nana and I were on our way home. In the car, Nana reminded me of an old chocolate lab we'd had when I was a kid in North Carolina, just before my parents died. The window was down and she was letting the air blow over her while the world flew by outside. I half expected her to start quoting Dr. King, "Free at last, free at last." Or maybe some choice line of Morgan Freeman's from The Bucket List. She turned to me and patted the upholstery with both hands.
How do they get these seats so comfortable? I could sleep much better here than in that hospital bed, I tell you that.
So you won't mind that we turned your room into a den, I deadpanned. She cackled and started to recline the seat.
Just watch me.
But when she got too low, her laugh turned into a coughing jag. Her lungs were still tentative. It doubled her over with a hacking sound that went right to my gut. I pulled over and got a hand behind her until I could raise the seat again. She waved me off, still coughing, but better. My own heart was working overtime. This recovery was going to be an interesting dance, I could tell. The coughing episode seemed like a good segue, so once we were moving again, I said, "Listen, Bree and I have been thinking about getting someone at the house." Nana gave a wordless grunt. "Just for when we're at work, maybe half a day."
"I don't need some over-solicitous stranger hovering around me and fluffing my pillows. It's embarrassing and costly. We need a new roof, Alex, not nursemaids."
"I hear you," I said. I'd been expecting that answer. "But I'm not going to feel comfortable leaving the house otherwise. We have enough money."
"Oh, I see." She folded her hands in her lap. "This is all about what you want. I understand perfectly now."
"Come on, let's not argue. You're going home," I said. But then I caught a little eye roll from her. She was just busting my chops because she could, for the sheer fun of it. Which was not to say she'd agree to anything about any nursemaid.
"Well,
at least the patient's in a good mood," I said.
"Yes, she is,"
Nana answered. We were coming onto Fifth Street, and she sat up a little higher in her seat.
"And no one, not even the great Alex Cross, is going to get under her skin on a day as nice as this one."
A few seconds later, she added,
"No nursemaids."
Chapter 33. A hastily made banner hung over the front door. It said, "Welcome home, Nana," in a half dozen colors. The kids came streaking out as soon as they saw us. I ran interference and scooped Ali off the ground before he could tackle Nana on the walkway. "Gently," I called to Janny, who had already put the brakes on some.
"We missed you so much," she shrieked.
Oh, Nana, welcome home. Welcome, welcome. Give me a real hug, Janelle. I'm not going to break.
Nana turned on like a light bulb and grinned. Ali insisted on carrying Nana's suitcase, which he thunk, thunk, thunked up the steps behind us, while Nana took my arm on one side, Janny's on the other. When we came into the kitchen, Bree was on the phone. She flashed a big smile Nana's way and held up a just-one-second finger.
Yes, sir. Yes, I will.
Thank you so much, said Bree into the receiver. Who was that? I asked. But Bree was already rushing over to give Nana a hug of her own.
Gently,
Ali said, which cracked Nana up.
I'm not a basket of eggs, she said. I'm a tough old bird.
We settled in at the kitchen table after Nana made it clear she'd go to bed when real people did, thank you very much. Once we were sitting, Bree cleared her throat like she had an announcement to make. She looked at each of us, then started in.
I've been thinking that maybe this whole idea of hiring someone to be here with Nana might not go over so well. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Nana gave me a look that said, see, I'm not so hard to figure out.
So, I'm going to cut back at work and stay home with you for a while, Nana. That is, if you'll have me.
Nana beamed.
That's so thoughtful, Bree, and you put it so well. Now that is a healthcare plan I can live with.
I was a little stunned. Cut back, I asked.
That's right. I'll stay available for whatever you need on Caroline's case, but everything else I'm farming out. Oh, and Nana, here.
She got up and took a sheaf of papers off the counter.
I printed these recipes out from the net. See if any of them look good to you, or not, whatever. You want some tea?
While Nana was reading, I followed Bree over to the stove. One look in her eyes and I realized that it would be wrong for me to ask if this was what she really wanted. Bree had always done what she wanted, and I mean that in a good way.
Thank you, I said quietly. You are the best.
She smiled to let me know that thanks weren't necessary here and also that she definitely was the best.
I love her too, she whispered.
Eggplant?
Nana held up one of the pages she'd been reading.
You can't make decent eggplant without salt. It's just not possible.
Well, keep looking,
Bree said, going over to sit down next to Nana. There's a ton more recipes. What about the crab cakes?
Crab cakes could work, Nana said.
I just hung back and watched the two of them for a while. It felt like a real circle of life moment. I noticed the way Bree leaned into Nana when they laughed, and the way Nana always seemed to keep a hand on Bree as if they'd been buddies forever. God willing, I thought, they would be for a long time to come.
Angel food cake with chocolate icing,
Nana said and beamed mischief.
Is that on your good-to-eat list, Bree?
Should be.
Chapter 34. When I got a call from my FBI friend Ned Mahoney the next day, I never would have guessed it had to do with Caroline's murder case. All he told me over the phone was to meet him at the food court at Tyson's Corner Center in McLean. Coming from anyone else, it would have seemed a strange request. Since it came from Ned, whom I trusted implicitly, I knew something was up. Ned was a pretty big deal, who had once headed the hostage rescue team at the FBI training facility out in Quantico. Now he had an even bigger job, supervising field agents up and down the East Coast. We'd worked together when I was an agent at the Bureau, and again, more recently, at a bizarre showdown with dirty cops from SWAT and some drug dealers in D.C. I sat down across from Ned at an orange plastic table with white plastic chairs where he was gulping coffee. I'm pretty busy these days. The hell you want, I said and grinned.
Let's walk, he said, and we got right back up. I'm busy too. Monty Donnelly says hello, by the way.
Hello back at Monty. So, Ned, what's on your mind? Why the John le Carré cloak and dagger stuff? I asked as we left the food court at a brisk pace. I know some interesting things about Caroline, he told me, point blank. Honestly, Alex, I wouldn't be talking to you if she wasn't your niece. This whole thing is getting hinkier and more dangerous every day. I stopped walking across from a store with David Sedaris' books stacked up high in the window. What whole thing? Ned, start me at the beginning. Mahoney is one of the smartest cops I've ever known, but information moves through his brain too fast sometimes. He began walking again, eyes scanning the mall. He was starting to make me nervous. We've had a surveillance team on a certain location in Virginia, private club, very heavy hitters. Alex, I'm talking about people who can go over both our heads, in more ways than one. Go on, I said. I'm listening to every word. He looked at the ground. You know that your niece was, Yeah, I know the forensics, all the other details. I saw her at the medical examiner's. He threw the rest of his coffee into a garbage can. It's possible, even probable, that Caroline was murdered by someone at that club. Hold on. We stopped again. I waited for a blonde mother with three small towheads and an armful of baby Gap bags to go by. Why is the bureau involved? Technically, Alex, because a body was transported across state lines. I thought of the mobster who'd been found and then lost, Johnny Tucci. You're talking about the punk from Philly? We have no interest in him. Chances are he's dead anyway. Alex, this club is frequented by some of the more important people in Washington. It's gotten heavy at the bureau in the last couple of days. Top heavy. I assume you mean Burns is involved. Ron Burns was the bureau's director and a decent guy. Mahoney shook his head. He wouldn't answer that one directly, but I could figure it out for myself. Ned, whatever happens, I'm only going to help. I figured as much, but listen, Alex, you should assume you're being watched on this one. It's going to get nasty like you wouldn't believe. The nastier the better. Just means somebody cares. I'll take my chances with that. You already have, Ned clapped me on the shoulder and offered a grim smile. You just didn't know it until now. Chapter 35. The meeting with Ned was useful, but it had also given me a headache, so I was playing a little Brahms in the car on the way back to Judiciary Square. I picked up a voicemail from Ramon Davies' secretary as I sped along the streets of D.C. The superintendent wanted to see me as soon as possible. That didn't sit too well on top of Ned's warning at the mall. The last time Davies called, it was to tell me that Caroline had been killed. When I got to the Daily Building, I bypassed the elevator and jogged up the stairs to the third floor. Davies' office door was open, and I rapped two knuckles on the frame. He was hunched over paperwork at his desk. The wall behind him was hung with some of his large collection of commendations, including MPD's Detective of the Year for 2002. I had the award for 04, but no big office to put a plaque up in. Actually, the certificate was in a drawer someplace at home. At least I thought it was. Davies nodded when he saw me. We weren't exactly friends, but we worked well together, and there was respect on both sides. Come in and close the door. As I sat down, I couldn't help noticing my own handwriting on some of the photocopied pages he was studying. Is that Caroline's file? I asked. Davies didn't answer at first. He sat back and eyeballed me for a few seconds. Then he said, I had a call this morning from Internal Affairs. There it was, just about the last thing I wanted to deal with right now. Internal Affairs used to be called the Office of Professional Responsibility. Before that, it was Internal Affairs. MPD is nothing if not fluid that way. What do they want? I asked. I think you know. Did you threaten that anchor asshole Ryan Willoughby at Channel 9? He says you did. So does his assistant. I sat back and took a breath before I answered. It's bullshit. Things got a little heated, that's all.
Okay. I had another call yesterday from a Congressman Mincer. Want to guess what he's calling about?
I couldn't believe it, though it was typical enough. Washington power playing and outright bullying. Both of their phone numbers were found in Caroline's apartment.
I don't need you to give me the 101. Not yet, anyway.
He held up the file to illustrate his point.
I just need to know that you've got a cool head on this.
I do. But this isn't just another homicide investigation, and I don't mean because my niece was killed and cut up into pieces.
Damn straight it's not, Alex. That's the whole point. These complaints could become a problem for you and for the entire investigation.
I was talking to Davies, but I was also trying to think this thing through. Citizen complaints, when they're investigated, can end up at one of four conclusions. They can be sustained, determined unfounded, deemed unprovable for lack of evidence, or the officer can be exonerated because no regulation was broken. I felt confident that at worst, I was in the last category. Davies wasn't done with me, though.
I give you more leeway than just about any detective in this division, he said.
Thank you. I'm handling it okay, right? Despite appearances. That got a microscopic grin. He studied me for another few seconds and then sat back. When he started putting away his notes, I knew we were over the hump, at least for right now.
I want you on this investigation, Alex, but believe me when I say that the minute, and I mean the minute, anyone tries to take this over my head, I'm pulling you off.
He stood up then, my sign to get out of there while I still could.
Keep me in the loop. I don't want to have to call you again. You call me.
Of course, I assured him, and then I left. If I stuck around longer, I'd have to tell him about my meeting with Ned Mahoney, and that was something I couldn't afford to do right now. Not if Davies was already considering reining me in. I'd tell him everything later, just as soon as I had some answers myself.
Chapter 36.
Tony Nicholson recalled a particular short story that had been popular when he was a schoolboy. He thought it was called The Most Dangerous Game. Well, he was playing such a game now, only in real life, and it was much more dangerous than some story in an anthology. Nicholson stared at the monitors on his desk, watching and waiting, forcing himself to go slowly on the scotch. Zeus was due any minute. At least he was scheduled to appear, and Nicholson had a decision to make. For months now, it had been the same game with this madman. Nicholson kept the carriage, barn, apartment vacant at all times, booked escorts whenever Zeus demanded it, and then tortured himself wondering if it would be suicide to record one of these little parties of his. Nicholson had seen plenty in the few sessions he'd watched, but he had no idea exactly what Zeus was capable of, or even who he was. The man definitely played rough, though. In fact, some of the escorts he'd had sessions with had completely disappeared. At least they'd never come back to work after seeing Zeus. Just after 12:30, a black Mercedes with tinted windows pulled up to the front gate. No one buzzed. Nicholson admitted the car remotely, then sat back, waiting for it to show up at the top of the drive. His fingers played compulsively back and forth over the keyboard's touchpad. Record, don't record. Record, don't record. Soon enough, the Mercedes passed in front of the house, then continued around toward the carriage barn and back, its destination. As always, the car's plates were covered. Before Zeus, the apartment had been a private VIP suite for any pre-approved client who could afford it. The fee started at $20,000 a night, and that was just for room and board. The suite was outfitted with the finest liquors and wines, a fully stocked gourmet kitchen, a marble steam room and Swiss shower, two fireplaces, and a full complement of electronics, including separately wired phone lines with routing software and multi-frequency voice scramblers to make outgoing calls untraceable. Nicholson pulled up the living room view, where two girls were waiting as ordered. All they knew was that it would be a party of one, and they'd been promised time and a half for the evening, a minimum of $4,000 each. When the door from the parking bay below opened, both of them stood up at once and started to primp. Nicholson's body tensed as he watched Zeus stride into the room, looking like any other client with his crisp blue suit, briefcase in hand, and a tan overcoat over his arm. Except for one thing. Zeus wore a mask. Always. Black. Like an executioner. "Hello, ladies. Very pretty. Very nice. Are you ready for me?" he asked. That was what he always said, too. And in the voice he always used. Too deep to be his real speaking voice. Another element of disguise. So who was this creepy, powerful, rich bastard?
Chapter 37.
Through the narrow peepholes in his mask, Zeus studied the two girls and thought they were gorgeous, just spectacular to look at. One was tall with long dark hair and alabaster skin. The other was a short dark beauty who was probably Hispanic. They had obviously been instructed not to ask about the mask or who he might be or anything of a personal nature. This was good. His mood couldn't have been any better. "I think we're going to have a good time tonight," he said. That was all they needed to know for now, and actually, he had no idea how tonight might go, only that it was completely in his control. He was, after all, Zeus. They took his words as a cue to speak and introduced themselves as Catherine and Renata. "Can I take your coat?" Catherine asked, and somehow managed to make it sound seductive. "Get you something to drink? What would you like? We have it all."
"No, thank you. I'm fine for now."
He was polite, but definitely reserved, even strange. For one thing, he never touched anything outside the bedroom. His people knew as much and would work accordingly.
"Let's go on in," he said. "You're the most beautiful girls I've seen here, by the way. I don't know which of you is prettier."
Everything in the bedroom was laid out as it should be. The windows were curtained. There was a bottle of Grey Goose vodka, a new box of latex gloves on the dresser, and nothing else. No knickknacks, no carpets, no bedding, except for a fitted rubber sheet covering the mattress.
"This is interesting." Catherine sat down and ran her hand over it. "Decor by Rubbermaid?"
Zeus made no comment. He had the two girls undress first, then took off his own clothes, except the mask, folding everything onto the dresser so he could leave the club just as neat and pressed as when he'd arrived. Finally, he opened his briefcase.
"I'm going to tie you girls up," he said. "Nothing too scary. They told you about this, correct?" "Good. Have either of you been handcuffed before?"
The shy one, Renata, shook her head no. The other, Catherine, put a come-fuck-me look into her eyes and nodded.
"Once or twice," she said. "And you know what? I still haven't learned to be a good girl."
"Don't do that, Catherine," he told her.
She looked at him as if she didn't know what he was talking about.
"Don't ever play act for me. Please. Just be yourself. I can tell the difference."
Before there could be any more nonsense, he tossed a pair of cuffs onto the bed.
"Put those on, please. What I'd like, I want you to share them. One cuff for each of you."
While the girls clipped the cuffs on, he slipped his hands into a pair of gloves and took out the rest of his gear. Two more pairs of cuffs, a new skein of hardware store rope, two red rubber ball gags with black leather straps.
"Just lie back now," he said, and went over to Renata first.
He could see something interesting now, mounting concern in her eyes, the beginning of fear.
"Give me your free hand," he said.
Then he cuffed her wrist to the bedpost.
"Thank you, Renata. You're very sweet. I like compliant women. It's my vice."
As he walked around to the other side, Catherine arched her back a little and widened her eyes, more vacant than scared.
"Please, don't hurt us. We'll do anything you want, I promise,"
Catherine said. She was getting him pissed, already,
like some cock-teasing little wife doing her coital duty. He slapped on the last cuff and secured it to the other bedpost and started fitting the gag into her mouth before she could say any more and ruin tonight. "I can tell you're still acting, and you're not good at it," he told her. "Now, you're making me a little angry. I'm sorry. I don't like myself when I get like this. You won't either." He tightened the strap at the back of her head. He used all of his strength, and he was a powerful man. The girl tried to say something, but it came out as a muted grunt. He'd caused her pain. Good. She deserved it. When he stepped back, the look on Catherine's face had changed completely. She was afraid of him now. That wasn't something you could fake. "Much better," he said. "Now, let's see if I can think of anything else to improve that performance of yours. Oh, how about these?" He reached into his black briefcase and pulled out a taser gun and pliers. "Catherine, that's wonderful. Your improvement is just outstanding. It's all in the eyes."
Chapter 38.
Nicholson felt as if he'd been drinking coffee all night instead of expensive scotch. He squinted at the headlights on Lee Highway, wishing for nothing more than a nightcap, an Ambien, and a few hours away from his own tortured thoughts. It was done, anyway. He'd wiped the hard drive and taken the disc away with him. He'd recorded Zeus's session with the two girls. He'd witnessed the horror show. The question now was what to do with it. It was tempting to drive around all night, put the thing in his safe deposit box, and hopefully never go back to it again. On the other hand, he thought, if the need did arise, he'd be smart to keep it closer at hand, just in case. Nicholson had never indulged in the idea that this scheme of his could go on forever. The discreet club and the dirty blackmail had been a delicate balance. With Zeus in the mix, it was untenable, and the madman showed no sign of slowing down. If Nicholson wanted out, he was going to have to disappear, and sooner rather than later. One contingency plan after another ran through his head as he drove. The offshore account in the Seychelles had just over $2 million in it. There was $150,000 coming from Temple Suter, and then the Al-Hamad party next week, which promised to be good for at least as much. It was no lifetime reserve, but it was certainly enough to get him out of the country and keep him more than comfortable for a while. Definitely a couple of years, maybe longer. He could fly through Zurich and lie low for a few weeks until he could get a second passport. Lots of countries offered acquisition programs. Ireland might draw the least notice. Then he could use it to fly back out again, perhaps heading east. He'd always heard the trade in flesh was outrageous in Bangkok. Maybe it was time to find out. Meanwhile, there was Charlotte. God, what had he been thinking when he married her? That he would turn that lump of clay into something worth keeping? She'd been a little nothing of a London schoolteacher when they met. Now she was a little nothing of an American housewife. It was like some kind of cruel joke on him. One thing was certain. Mrs. Nicholson would definitely not be making the trip east or wherever he ended up. The only question was whether he should find someone to finish her off. Just one more body at this point, and well worth the $20,000 or $30,000 it would cost. Anything to keep that gob of hers from flapping after he was gone. It was just after 4 a.m. when Nicholson finally got home. His mind was still racing as he came down the short curved slope of his driveway, and he nearly rear-ended the black Jeep four-door parked right in front of the garage. What the hell? His first cogent thoughts were of the disc in his glove box, and of Zeus. Jesus, was it possible somebody already knew about the recording? Could it be true? Not wanting to find out, Nicholson jammed the car into reverse, but even that was too little too late. A fat man was already at his side window, pointing a handgun and shaking his head no.
Chapter 39.
What was this, the Sopranos? It certainly looked like it to Nicholson. There were two of them. A second hoodlum-looking gent stepped into the glow of the headlights, pointing another gun at his face. The fat one opened Nicholson's door for him and then stepped back.
The guy's mouth hung open a little, and his cheap golf shirt was tucked in, leaving an impressive curve of belly suspended in midair. It seemed inconceivable that someone as sloppy as this should be working for Zeus, which left the obvious question.
"Who the hell are you?" Nicholson asked. "What do you want with me?"
"We work for Mr. Martino." The accent was New York or Boston or something, East Coast American.
Nicholson slowly got out of the car, keeping both hands in sight.
"Okay, then, who the hell is Mr. Martino?" he asked.
"No more stupid questions," the corpulent thug gestured Nicholson toward the house. "Let's go inside. We're right behind you, bub."
It occurred to Nicholson that he'd already be dead if this were a straightforward hit, so that meant they wanted something else. What? They were barely inside the front door when Charlotte Nicholson's thin, very irritating voice came seeping down from the upstairs hall.
"Babe, who's that with you? Isn't it late for guests?"
"It's nothing, not your concern. Go back to bed, Charlotte."
Even now, he felt like throttling her just for being where she shouldn't be. Her bare, splayed feet and legs came into the light from the foyer as she took a step down.
"What's going on?"
she called out again.
"Did you not hear me? Go, now."
She seemed to pick up on his tone anyway and floated back into the darkness.
"Stay up there," he told her. "I'll come and get you later. Go to sleep."
He took his two unexpected guests through to the great room at the back for more privacy. Also, the bar was there, and Nicholson headed straight for it.
"I don't know about you fellas, but I could use a drink," he said,
then felt a sharp crack at the back of his skull. He stumbled down onto his knees.
"What the fuck do you think this is, a social call?"
shouted the fat guy. Nicholson felt angry enough to fight, but he was in no position to do it. Not even close. So he pulled himself up, then onto the sofa. Thankfully, his vision was slowly coming back into focus.
"So, what the hell do you want at 4 in the morning?
The fat one hovered over him.
"We're looking for one of our guys. He came down here about a week and a half ago, and we haven't heard from him since."
Christ, he wanted to lay out this fat bastard, but that wasn't going to happen, at least not right now. But someday, somewhere.
"I'm going to need more information than that. What guy? Give me a hint."
"The name's Johnny Tucci," said Fat Boy.
"Who? Never heard of him. Tucci? Did he come to my club? Who is he?"
"Don't bullshit us, man,"
the smaller punk pushed in close now with a rush of cigarette and body stink.
"We know all about your little place in the country, okay?"
Nicholson sat up straight on the couch. This might have more to do with Zeus than he'd thought, or maybe with his business on the side.
"That's right," the punk went on. "You think Mr. Martino sends his people down here for a vacation?"
"Listen, I still have no idea what you're talking about," he told them.
That much was partly the truth. Fat Boy hunkered down on the burled wood coffee table and lowered his gun for the first time. It might have been an opening if the other punk weren't so close by.
"I'm going to lay it out for you then,"
he said in an almost conciliatory tone.
"One of our guys is missing. Whoever's been contracting with our boss isn't easy to track down. So far, all we got is you. And that means our problem just became your problem. You understand?"
Nicholson was afraid that he did.
"Well, what do you expect me to do about our problem?"
The guy shrugged, then scratched his stubbly chin with the barrel of his gun.
"Bottom line, we gotta deliver somebody back to Mr. Martino. So you do some asking around, find out what you can, or you'll be the one we bring back."
"Or the little lady up on the stairs,"
the other one said.
"You can have the little lady," Nicholson said. "We'll call it even."
The heavy man smiled finally, and then he stood up. The night's business was clearly done.
"I'll take that drink to go," he said to Nicholson. "You just stay put."
He waddled over to the bar where his buddy was already helping himself to as many bottles as he could carry in both arms. Once the two punks were gone, and Nicholson had his drink and some ice for his head, he noticed they'd cleaned him out of Johnny Walker, only to leave a Dalmore 62 sitting right there on the bar. It was a $400 bottle, and seemed as ominous a sign as anything else. If these two losers were onto him, then everything was unraveling faster than he'd thought possible.
"Now, who the hell was
Johnny Tucci.
Chapter 40.
For Suarez and Overton, every exchange with Zeus was a dead drop. No face-to-face meetings ever, by mutual agreement with whoever was actually paying their fees. They went into the suite at Blacksmith Farms after him, sanitized the space, and took away whatever needed taking away, including the bodies. Just before dawn, their no-profile G6 bumped along the familiar dirt track in the backwoods of Virginia. Its rear end was riding a little low because of the weight in the trunk.
"Let me ask you this," Suarez said to his partner. "He's obviously filthy rich. Why does he risk it? What is he, completely crazy?"
"On some level, sure."
"On some level? How about 24/7, 365? He's crazier than a shithouse rat on speed. How does he get away with it? How?"
"Well, for one thing, do you know who he is, Suarez?"
"You're right. I don't. But somebody has to know. Somebody has to stop him, eventually."
"What can I tell you? Welcome to the wackadoo world of the rich and famous. Can you say wood chipper?"
Chapter 41.
Remy Williams didn't trust these two guys at all. Never had, not from the start of the contract. When they pulled up to the cabin and didn't even get out of the car, he knew something was up. Something more than the usual dirtbag routine.
"How's it going, fellas?"
He shuffled on over like the piece of white trash he was supposed to be.
"What have you got for me this time?"
"Two female."
The driver looked up, though not quite into his eyes. What was this? Did the Latino have a conscience?
"One of them has a bullet in the chest. You'll see."
"Oh, yeah? What'd you shoot her for?"
"I don't know. Maybe because we're still chasing down the last one who ran off."
The guy was baiting him. Remy could tell, but he wasn't sure why or really what these murders were all about. He was just a cog, didn't have all the pieces. Figured probably no one did. Like JFK. Like RFK. Hell, like OJ.
"Seems to me you shot the last one, too," he said, playing along. "Maybe she didn't run off at all. Maybe just be lying out in those woods somewhere, turning into mulch as we speak. Could have just been found by hikers."
"Yeah, maybe."
The ex-agent took a deep breath, starting to get a little showy with his aggravation.
"Listen, if you could just clean out the trunk, we'll be on our merry way."
Remy scratched at his crotch. Little overkill, maybe. And then shuffled around to the back of the car. The driver popped the trunk for him.
"Jesus, look at this."
The two bodies were double-wrapped in black poly sheeting and sealed with packing tape. These guys were pros at what they did. He had to give them that much. But who the hell was hurting these girls in the first place? What was the big picture here? Who was the killer? He dragged both packages out of the trunk and onto the canvas tarp he'd already spread. His tools were laid out on a big hickory stump, and there was an extra gallon of gas next to the chipper.
"Which one you say was shot?"
he called over to the spooks.
"Tall one. Left chest. What a waste. Girl was a real looker."
He rolled her over and slit the plastic down the middle, pushing just hard enough with the tip of his Bowie knife to leave a thin red trail in its wake. When he pulled back the wrapper, he found a small crater just above the very well-formed left breast. The body was still warm. In the 90s or high 80s. Dead only a few hours at the most.
"Okay, got it. You want me to pull the slug or do you care?" "Pull it, get rid of it." "All righty." "Done. Anything else?"
"Yeah, close the trunk."
A few seconds later, the two smart-ass bastards were gone. Distrust aside, Remy didn't mind their arrogance, mostly because he knew it worked in his favor. Probably never even occurred to these two how expendable they were, or how vulnerable. In fact, they'd already done a good bit of the work for him when they erased their own identities. Now they were just a couple of spooks, and Remy knew as well as anyone that when the time came, there was nothing easier to make disappear than a ghost. He could do that. Hell, he'd done it before. Made a career of it, actually. He unwrapped the second girl, another real looker. Seemed like maybe she'd been strangled and bitten. He massaged the girl's lukewarm breasts, played around a little bit more, then took the two of them up the hill to the chipper. What a waste was right. Who the hell would do such a thing? Somebody even crazier than he was?
Chapter 42. I had another clandestine meeting with Ned Mahoney Saturday afternoon, this time at a busy parking garage on M Street in Georgetown. As I pulled in, I couldn't help thinking about those deep throat scenes in All the President's Men, the book and the movie. There was a definite cloak and dagger thing happening here. Why was that? What in hell was going on? Ned was already waiting when I got out of the car. He handed me a manila folder with the bureau's seal on it. Inside, I found some notes and a collection of photos, copied two to a page. What's this? Renata Cruz and Catherine Tenencore, he said. Both missing, presumed dead. Each picture showed one of the girls in several locations around town, with a variety of mostly white, much older men. Is that David Wilkie? I asked, pointing at someone who looked very much like the current chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Ned nodded. That's David Wilkie, all right. Both women have powerful men as regular clients, which is why we've been tracking them to begin with. Catherine Tenencore, at least, worked at the club out in Virginia. I didn't say a word, just stared at Mahoney. I know exactly what you're thinking, he said. Might as well break out the legislative directory while we're at it. This whole thing was getting more insidious by the minute. There was no way to track this killer or this network, if that's what we were looking at, without exposing all kinds of very dirty laundry in the process. A lot of innocent family members' lives would be ruined, and that was just the start of it. House and Senate majorities, not to mention presidential elections and governorships, had been lost over a lot less than this. No one would be going down without a fight, either. I already had a bad taste of that from internal affairs. Anyone who thinks that cops look forward to these sensational, career-making cases has never been in the middle of one.
Jesus, Ned. It's like waiting for a hurricane to happen right here in D.C. More like running after one. Looking for trouble, he said. A real Category 5 shitstorm. Don't you just love Washington?
Actually, I do. Just not right at this minute.
So, listen, Alex. His voice went serious again. The Bureau's all over this. It's about to go pop. I totally understand if you want to back off, and if you do, now would be a good time. Just hand the envelope full of goodies back.
I was a little surprised by the offer. I thought Ned knew me a lot better than that, which meant, of course, that this offer carried a serious warning. Does that mean you're ready to hit the club out in Virginia? I asked him.
I'm waiting on the ex parte right now.
And? Ned grinned, and if I'm not mistaken, he looked just a little relieved.
And you should probably leave your phone on when you go home tonight. I'll be calling.
Chapter 43. The good news was I got to have a nice dinner with the family. I even got to spend some time hanging out with the kids afterward, just before all hell would probably break loose, probably like nothing I'd ever experienced before. It all depended on who was at the private club tonight. Jenny had been teaching Ali to play Sorry, one of the most boring games in the universe, but I liked playing just about anything with the two of them. I goofed around between my turns, stealing pieces off the board and telling old jokes to Ali. Things like, why is 6 afraid of 7?
Because 7, 8, 9,
Jenny cackled. She loved to be the spoiler, and Ali was a perfect audience. The boy just loves to laugh. He's the least serious of my three kids by far. Nana sat off to the side, watching us over the top of 1,000 Splendid Suns, one of the books she'd been tearing through these days. She and Bree had settled into a tentative partnership, with Bree slowly asserting herself around the house and Nana, learning she could afford to let go of a few things she'd always controlled, like how to load the dishwasher. It was all good, until the phone rang. Usually I expect the kids to put up an immediate stink when that happens. "Don't answer it, Daddy," had become a common refrain around our house. So when both of them just looked away, waiting for the inevitable, I felt even worse. I checked the ID. It was Mahoney, as promised. "I'm sorry. I really do have to take this," I said to Ali and Jenny. Their silence was loud and clear as I went out to the hall to answer. "Ned?"
"Where go, Alex? There's a Holiday Inn off exit 72 in Arlington. I can meet you in the parking lot if you come now. Right now."
Chapter 44. It was called Operation Coitus Interruptus, which only goes to prove that there are some people in the FBI with a sense of humor. Ned's full team had convened at a small farm in Culpeper County, about an hour and a half west of D.C., and not far from Shenandoah National Park. It was a strange, foreboding mix. Mahoney and his co-case agent, Renee Victor, six HRT agents, three crisis negotiators from the Tactical Support Branch, and a 10-man FBI SWAT team. I'd been expecting an all-HRT team, but I wasn't concerned in the least. FBI SWAT has some of the best tactical units in the world. This was going to be quite a show. There was also a rep from Virginia State Police, who had two collection wagons on standby, and me. I'm not sure what strings Ned had to pull to have me there, but I appreciated it, and I knew that he figured I would add value. We all gathered around the tailgate of someone's pickup for a quick briefing from the big guy.
"There will be some heavy hitters inside, but for us, it's going to be SOP all around," Ned told the group. "I want SWAT in first, then agents, and I want all exits secure at all times. You should be prepared for any scenario, including sexual situations and even violent resistance. I'm not expecting the latter, but it's possible. Anything is. The idea is to work fast and safe and to clear this place out as cleanly as we can." Surveillance showed that the main house had entrances on the north, south, and east sides. Mahoney divided us into three units accordingly. I'd be going in the front door with him. There were also several outbuildings which were supposed to be empty, at least tonight. I couldn't help wondering about the kinds of parties held in them. Before we left, Ned gave me an FBI jacket and a new Aramid vest from the back of his car. The vest was lighter than anything I'd used before, which was okay, since we were hiking in from a couple of miles away. It took 45 minutes to get there through pretty thick woods and brush. After the first mile or so, we switched to night vision only, those with goggles leading those without. All conversation dropped off at that point, except for the occasional radio exchange between Mahoney and the SWAT commander. The main house came up quickly over a steep rise, all three stories of it. We hung just out of sight, about 75 yards off the front. Ned sent SWAT out to do a quick 360, and I borrowed a pair of binoculars for a better look while we waited for the action to start. It was a really large limestone mansion. There's no other word for it. And the driveway was a virtual car show tonight. Mercedes, Rolls, Bentley, even a vintage Lamborghini and a red Ferrari. Tall mullioned windows ran along the first floor, which was well lit inside, but there were no people that I could see. Presumably the action was taking place upstairs, where all the windows were dark or at least shaded. Was this where Caroline had been killed? The thought came over me like a shroud. Was it also where her body had been so horribly desecrated? For that matter, were we about to crack open somebody's butcher shop or just a rich man's playground? It was a strange feeling to have no idea what to expect. Word finally came back to Mahoney. I couldn't hear anything from his headset, but it looked like the main event was about to happen. He radioed a standby to the other units, which had spread out around the property,
and then gave me that gallows humor grin of his.
You ready for coitus interruptus?
As I'll ever be, I said.
Here we go, then. Should be a gas.
He went back to his headset and counted off.
All units on the ready. Don't hurt anybody. Don't get hurt.
A few seconds later, SWAT was out of the woods with the rest of us just behind, sprinting toward the impressive house of ill repute. Chapter 45. An expensive-looking walnut front door splintered and then gave way. SWAT was inside with no difficulty. I had my Glock out, hoping I wouldn't have to use it. The last time Ned and I had worked together, we'd both been shot. Not this time, I hoped. This was white-collar crime, wasn't it? As soon as we got the all-clear from SWAT, Ned left two men at the door, then led everyone else inside. My first impression was just, well, money. The foyer was three stories high, with a checkerboard marble floor and huge chandeliers dangling like outrageous jewels overhead. The furniture was gleaming antiques, and there was something odd about the light. It looked like gold in here. The second impression I got was of stunningly beautiful women, a lot of them, some in evening gowns, others in various stages of undress. Three were naked and not being very shy about it, hands on their hips like we'd just busted into an apartment they all shared. The escorts, expensive ones, from clean-cut all-American to exotic Far Eastern. I moved through the foyer and turned right, past another agent shuttling two dark-skinned men speaking Arabic and a tall black woman toward the front. All three were naked, and they were cursing out the agents as if they were household help. I passed open, empty parlors on either side, then came to a glass-walled smoking room at the end of the house. It stank of cigars and sex, but nobody was inside at the moment. When I doubled back, I could hear shouting from near the entrance. Somebody was objecting to our presence, and loudly.
Get your hands off me! Don't touch me, you wanker!
A tall blonde man with an English accent was attempting to come down the big main staircase while two FBI agents held him back.
This is an illegal search, goddammit.
The Englishman had some spine. I could see that much. They finally had to put him down on the marble landing just to get a zip tie around his wrist. I took the stairs two at a time, to where Mahoney was trying to question the guy.
Are you in charge here? You're Nicholson, right?
Piss off! I've already called my attorney. You're trespassing, every one of you.
He was well over 6 feet and didn't seem to be losing steam.
You're breaking the law just being here. This is private property. God damn it, let me up. This is an outrage. This is a private party in a private house.
Keep him separated from the others, Mahoney told the agents. I don't want Mr. Nicholson talking to anyone else. We quickly established a couple of holding areas on the first floor and started working through the house, cutting the paying customers off from the staff, taking names as best we could.
Yes, my name is Nicholson. Very soon, you won't be able to forget it,
I heard from one of the rooms.
Nicholson, like the moving picture star.
Chapter 46. It was as bizarre a raid as I'd seen since I'd been on the force. Pretty funny, actually, if you have a sense of humor like mine. We pulled one joker out of a concrete block room, where he was still manacled to the wall in his thong underwear, presumably ditched there by his dominatrix. In fact, most of the people I saw were in one state of undress or another, completely naked, satin underwear, skimpy see-through robes, and one soaking wet couple in towels, including turbans, the male smoking a cigar. The men were a mix of Saudi and American. From what I gleaned, one was a billionaire by the name of Al-Hamad. He was having a birthday party that night, and a very happy 50th to you, one you won't forget. We kept the English manager, if that's what he was, in a small study downstairs. By the time I got back to him, he'd settled into a stubborn silence. When I asked about the bruise on his cheek, Mahoney told me he'd taken to spitting at the arresting officer. Never a good idea. I stood in the doorway, watching him sulk on an antique settee, surrounded by high shelves of books I couldn't imagine anyone had ever read. He was obviously a nasty son of a bitch, and presumably a pimp. But was he also a killer? And why was he acting so arrogant about the raid? His lawyer got there less than an hour later, wearing suspenders and a bow tie in the middle of the night. If I'd seen him on the street, I'd never have expected he was tied into something like this. He was Dilbert, minus the pocket protector. Unfortunately, his paperwork was very good. "What's this?" Mahoney asked, as the lawyer handed it over to him. "Motion to quash. As of this moment, your ex parte's void, and this raid is illegal. My client will generously allow you 5 minutes to clear out. After that, we're looking at contempt of court and criminal trespassing." Mahoney did a slow double take between the lawyer's little bug eyes and the motion to quash. Whatever he saw seemed to have the intended effect. He dropped the pages to the floor and walked away as they fluttered. Then I heard him shouting orders and shutting everyone down, the entire raid. I picked up the motion and started scanning. "Who the hell's your judge at 1 in the morning? I asked the lawyer. He actually reached up and flipped the page for me, pointed. "The Honorable Lawrence Gibson." Of course, I thought. Senators, congressmen, billionaires for clients, why not a judge? Part 3. With or Without You. Chapter 47. I got home early Sunday morning, somewhere between the newspaper delivery trucks and the overzealous joggers heading to the park. Whoa, what was this? I found Nana on the sun porch, fast asleep in one of the wicker chairs. Other than her ancient pink terry slippers, she was already dressed for church in a gray flannel skirt and white sweater set. This would be Nana's first service since the hospital visit, and the whole family was going. I put a hand on her shoulder, and she woke with a shrug. All it took was one quick look at my face. "Bad night?" she asked. I flopped down on the love seat across from her. "Am I that obvious all the time?" "Only to the initiated." "All right, tell me what happened. Talk to me." If this were any other case, I would have pleaded exhaustion, but Nana deserved to know about it. Still, I kept the details down to a PG rating. There was no need to overemphasize the dark side of Caroline's life. Nana knew, I was sure. She always seemed to, somehow. By the time I got to the part about the geeky lawyer with the motion to quash, I started getting worked up all over again. I'd just wasted a whole night, and I'd run out on Ali and Janny to do it. "I think Janny has that pouting cold shoulder thing down pat, though," I said. "How are they after I left?"
"Oh, you know, they'll survive," she said, but then added, "assuming that's all you need them to do."
It was like a pat on the head and a smack on the cheek at the same time. Pure Nana Mama. "So that was your twin sister waving me out the door last night, telling me it was all good. See, I could have sworn it was you."
"Now, don't get defensive on me, Alex."
She sat up a little straighter and cricked her neck, massaging it on one side.
"I'm just saying, the children don't always care why you're gone, Alex. They just know that you are. Especially little Damon."
"You mean Ali?"
"That's what I said, isn't it? The boy's only 6, after all."
I leaned in for a better look at her. "How much sleep did you get last night?" She made her psst sound.
"Old people don't need sleep. It's one of the secret advantages. Reason I can still whip you in a debate. Now help me up, and I'll start some coffee. You look like you could use it."
I had a hand on her elbow, and she was halfway up when she stopped suddenly and sagged a little. What is it? I asked.
Nothing. I just...
At first, she looked confused. Then all at once, her face creased with pain and she doubled over in my arms. Before I could even get her back down again, she'd passed out. Oh, God, no. Her small body was like nothing to hold in my arms. I laid her gently on the love seat and felt for a pulse at her neck. There was none. Nana, can you hear me? Nana! My heart was flying now. The doctors at St. Anthony's had told me the signs to look for. No movement, no breath, and she just lay there, horribly still. Nana was in cardiac arrest. Chapter 48. It was another nightmare. The EMTs in the house, the blur of the ambulance ride,